Can you hear me? Can you hear me? 1, 2, 3. Can you hear me? In the documentation, programming for Windows programming, it says channel 5. Раз, два, три, 1, 2, 3. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Помогите ему настроить наушничек. Channel 5. Channel 5. 1, 2, 3. Can you hear me? You don't hear me? You can hear me. Good. So once again, my question. In the documentation for Windows programming, it says that operations for syncing, like wait function, they give memory barriers. For all other functions, syncing functions like key user, RPC, or simple work with the queues, it doesn't say that they give these limitations. So does it happen? Can we hope that this is available or not? And we need to put memory barriers by hand, manually, in these cases.
You're saying synchronization primitives, like wait for single object, include memory barriers, but RPC functions, another synchronization like that, don't?
No, I'm saying that in documentation, in manuals, nothing speaks about it. So are they available or not in the RPC and other functions? So that's my question.
Not sure what you mean by RPC and other functions. Sorry. For synchronization.
Well, for example, queue user RPC. Queue user RPC. Queue, like the what, like queues. Queue user in RPC. It's a function. Queue user RPC. It's the function. APC, APC, queue user APC. APC. Queue user APC, yeah.
Around the operations that occur before the queue. The item is inserted in the queue and the other thread picks up the item. I doubt it. I think you'd have to take care of the memory barrier yourself in that case. But okay. I don't know for sure. Send me an email and I'll look into it.
Okay, thank you.
Ну, мы начинаем с...
У кого?
Veiko, I have two questions. The first, 3 years ago you told you have no plan to make these internal utilities not even localized, but localizable. It is possible you'll change your mind. What has to happen for this?
Good question. The questions about sysinternals, I've never made them localizable, even so that other people could localize. And the reason that I haven't is just it's more work. And I'm very driven by feedback that I get from the market, the customers.
So if we all ask you to make them localizable.
How many people are in the room? This number plus 100.
We can suggest using our help.
Yeah, I mean, suggest it. So for me, the time I spend on the tools is my hobby. It's not part of my official activities at Microsoft. And so I want to maximize the use of my time. And typically that means adding functionality, fixing bugs, creating new tools. Localizing the tools is a lot of work as well, but doesn't really further the tools. I know a lot of people would find that useful, but again, I haven't gotten a lot of feedback over the years that that's been a problem.
So we cannot have
if I do get a lot of people asking for it, then I'd consider doing it. And specific tools, too. Like if you said this tool.
So we must create a flash mob.
Yes, flash mob would be good. Yeah, I'd be impressed by that enough to...
Okay, another question. Almost 20 years ago, I've read, as far as I know, it was Windows NT Journal, that in difference with Windows 3.1, the window which use the single system system area for all process, the Windows NT use different system area for each process. But you in Windows internals write that there is one system area for any for all process. I think this is not accurate.
So there was no distinction really in Windows 95 and Windows 3.1, that line of operating systems, between user and system. So the user address spaces all coexisted with each other, at least large chunks of them. So, and there was no protection between the user part of the address space and the parts of the address space that were...
No, I don't mean the protection.
Yeah.
In Windows 95, if one process set a breakpoint in any in some DLL, then any process which called this DLL make this breakpoint to work. In Windows NT, there is no such.
That's correct.
So there is different codes in the same address.
Yes.
So this cannot be the single system area.
So the I guess it's a question of terminology. The system area that we're talking about, which is system DLLs, they're still considered user, part of the user address space.
Yes. Copy to write.
Yeah, copy on write.
Copy on write, yes.
Yeah.
But this creates a different area.
Well, it's still part of the user. So in Windows NT line of operating systems, the address space is split into user-owned and system-owned. And then user-owned, that's where all user mode DLLs get mapped, including things like kernel 32.
So they are mapped from the same area,
yeah.
But each process has its own area.
So they're mapped copy and write, like you pointed out, into each process's address space. So if you set a breakpoint, you're creating a private page with a breakpoint instruction on it for your process's user mode.
And the process I have to process one process set breakpoint, and the other process doesn't set breakpoint.
That's right.
So they have two different system areas.
Well, they've got two different address spaces.
Yes.
System area, when I hear you say that, I hear the system part of the address space.
Sorry, this is a copy of old book.
Yeah. So this is system address space.
Yes.
The DLLs you're talking about where breakpoints are set are up here. They're mapped up here.
This area is different for each process. Memory.
This is not. This is shared.
Yes.
This is shared by everybody.
Yes, shared. The source. Yes. the source code, which system allocates, is.
Well, this is.
Which is shared. Is common. But each process has its own addresses. They allocate.
Yeah. Well, actually, let me boot my laptop so in case I need to draw pictures or something for other people to see. But let me try to answer that again. What that's showing in the picture, so that picture he's showing from Windows internals is the address space breakdown, and it has at the top user mode address space, and at the bottom it says system, and system really means kernel mode address space, and the kernel mode address space is shared by all of the user mode processes.
Yes.
But system DLLs that you're talking about are mapped into the user mode part of the address space.
But each process has its own system address area.
No, they all share the same.
Yes, they map in the same area. For example, I write to
yes, they all have their own page tables, but all of the mappings for system, except for a few, are shared by all of them.
Okay, I have two apps.
Yes.
App 1 and App 2. App 1 use DLL 1 and does not use DLL 2. App 2, use DLL2 and do not use DLL1.
Uh-huh.
The system assigns addresses, address A to DLL1 and address B to DLL2.
Okay.
If the system area is...
Those DLLs are not in the system area. Those DLLs are in the user area. The only things in the system area are kernel mode components, like the operating system kernel and device drivers. All the DLLs are in the user part of the address space.
Well, okay. I'll send you an email, okay?
Okay.
Okay, let's talk about... Let's talk about Azure.
Okay.
What is the possible reason of the deployment stuck in the transition state for an hour while deploying? We've got that issue twice while working with Azure. First time only support team helped us, and on the second team it was restored by itself since several hours. So I, on your previous session, I saw timeouts at about 25 minutes or so, and what could stuck it more than hours?
A bug.
Thank you. good answer.
That's my technical evaluation of the situation.
So you got my bug report.
Okay. Well, if you get that, we need to get the details on the deployment so that we can look into what's causing that.
Okay, understood. And my another question is about general.
Oh, I can't display off this because there's no HDMI in here. So.
About general development practices. So, special tooling is used? What special tools do you use for development? And what hardware configuration do you use for development?
In Azure? Or me, personally?
You personally.
Yeah.
And what do you think... what tooling are you using in the Azure team?
So my personal tooling is for sysinternals work. Is that what?
Whatever.
Okay. So it's this laptop, an X100 Lenovo, which I take on the road, and I do work on that. And for my desktop machine, it's a standard issue Microsoft development workstation. It's got like 8 gig of RAM. It's quad core, 2-way hyper-threaded, Xeons, nothing particularly fancy. Now at home, for my homework, I've got a nice tower with, I can't remember the latest video cards I've got in them, water-cooled, 12 gig of RAM, it's 6-core hyper-threaded. Basically, I didn't want to ever run into a game that I couldn't run at maximum setting, and that so that's my game, my home system. And what's what kind of software tools? Visual Studio. I mean, Visual Studio and Windows Debugger for and virtual machines. This isn't being recorded, is it? So. You know, the Hyper-V was brought into Windows 8. At work, actually, I use Hyper-V for my virtual machine debugging. The drawbacks of Hyper-V, actually, are that it's designed for IT pro scenarios. It's designed for headless operation, not for dev test. So it's designed for you launch the VM and you never look at it. Whereas dev test, you want to look at the thing, interact with it, and you like to copy things to and from it. So for that, I used to use virtual PC, but we kind of let that die. So for that kind of dev test scenario, Instead of using Hyper-V, I prefer something like VirtualBox.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know if it's eligible question, but that's about ARM and Windows coming to that architecture. Windows RT looks a lot like Windows 8 in terms of the same control panel, the same processes. So is it the same libraries, I don't know, the same code somehow transferred to ARM, or is it just look alike?
No, it's built from the same source. So it is the same kernel underneath. There's different hardware architecture, so there's some different binaries. And, you know, there's the PC architecture, and then there's the SoC, system on a chip, architecture of the ARM devices, which the hardware abstraction layer was modified in Windows 8 to have a plug-in model so that additional extensibility could be plugged into it to support the SoC architecture. But other than that, it's all the same, built from the same source code.
So it doesn't take a lot of effort to transfer a program, for example, from x86 to ARM.
No, does not.
So it's mainly a technical job, right?
It's just it's a porting job, the same as porting the source to any other architecture.
Hmm. Okay, thank you.
Следующий вопрос. Желательно по облачной
платформе. Next question. About cloud platform, if you may.
Is, I believe, quite common, and it's related to tracing some kind of bugs or issues in Windows Azure. When I upload something or make something, it's quite hard to debug because I doesn't have a console like Hyper-V gives me to trace my virtual machine when it's not reachable. For example, when network interface is down, or maybe I upload a Linux machine and have something with the kernel and it's not loading. I know that one approach is to connect this VHD to another machine and, for example, to look at the registry or to look at logs. But sometimes I need to trace the load process. And how can it be done? And maybe you have some plans to make such support because it really makes some pain.
Yeah. So actually, this is funny that you should ask this question because there's been a lot of debate, discussion about this very topic recently. And one of the things we looked at, we're looking at doing, is providing visual display, like VM Connect view of what's going on in the virtual machine. It's my opinion that that only has limited, it provides limited visibility into what a problem is. I mean, if you see that something's stuck at boot, or if the network interface is down, you see the thing boot, but you can't tell why it's not talking out the network interface. Instead, I think that instead of investing resources in that, we'll invest resources into an agent that you can put inside the virtual machines that will have it by default in our platform images that will spit things out through the hypervisor channel into a log that will show you key system events during the boot process.
Okay, great.
More questions?
Hello. I have a question about the links are not perfect in Russia, right? And for example, when we have this cloud operating system or services, so the question is, do you have any special tweaks or special protocols that are optimizing the information that is sent out from the cloud to the end user's PC? And if you have a plans to release some probably new versions of protocols.
So like compression protocols?
Yeah, or? With the good compression.
Yeah, I mean, there's this SPDY, S-P-D-Y, compression protocol I think Google's pushing, which is the web server compressing automatically and the clients decompressing. And that's one protocol that's being proposed is for standardization to accelerate these kind of connections over weak links. We're looking at possibly adopting that, but there's some other competing protocols too, including one that Microsoft had come up with that we're also looking at. So I'm sure we will do something because the world is recognizing the need for this. And so the question is, what do we all do so that we don't have a fractured landscape of protocols? But I don't know what the answer is yet.
Thanks.
Yeah, hi Mark. In our solution, we tried to use memcached in the Windows Azure. So it was deployed on the virtual machine, the worker role. But the response from this worker role was maybe 5 times less than response on the local network. Why could it be so?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. I mean, the network latency between a virtual machine and another one, I don't know if you were in the session, but it's roughly half a millisecond for 8K packet. And that's typical kind of LAN latencies that you'll see. So I don't, virtualized LAN. What's that?
So is there any way to reduce this?
So what kind of latencies were you seeing?
The response was maybe 100 milliseconds.
Wow, that's way slower than you should be seeing. I don't know. We just released Windows Azure Caching, which is...
It's the same.
It's the same, but and it supports Memcached. You're seeing the same latencies for that?
Yeah.
100 milliseconds?
Yeah.
So if you send me an email with how you're measuring this, I'll look into what's causing the problem.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, hello. The question is about Silverlight.
Silverlight.
About Silverlight.
Yeah, I can go ahead and stop you there because I don't know anything about Silverlight.
Well, another question is we used Hyper-V virtual machines. What is the best practice about delivering SQL Server on virtual machines? Is it better to deliver SQL Server on virtual machine or on real machine or on host? Or is dynamic VHDs slow down virtual SQL Server too much?
If performance is your only criteria, then of course it's better not to run it in a virtual machine. You run it in a virtual machine for the management benefits that you'll get from that. The SQL Azure, for example, run-ins in virtual machines on Windows Azure. And we've been working on optimizing the performance of that, the same kinds of performance optimizations anybody would follow to optimize the performance of SQL Server in any virtualized environment. You'll get the best performance with pass-through disks. You get second best performance with fixed disks. You get the next best performance with VHDX disks on Windows Server 2012. And then, of course, there's dynamic VHDs, which comes next. The dynamic VHDs, the performance overheads you're going to pay are file expansion overhead, zero fill overhead for out-of-order writes to the VHD. The footer, you pay cost on footer for VHD format versus VHDX, where every time the file extends, there's updates are made to dynamic VHD, the footer has to be updated as well. So the bottom line is go in that order if you can in terms of getting the best performance out of the system.
Are there any limitations or differences in the work of Hyper-V and the Windows A compared to Windows Server 2012?
Limitations?
Limitations or differences?
Yeah, lots of differences. No limitations. No. Difference-wise, I mean, the storage systems, the REFS file system driver, storage spaces, the network virtualization support that's in Server 2012, Hyper-V migration capabilities that were introduced that do storage migration, the support for larger VMs, the support for more RAM, the support for more cores. Those are just some of the changes. Jeffrey Snover, who's walking around here, had several blog posts on Server 2012 changes on the Windows Server blog that you might want to check out.
Good evening. We heard about the job that Microsoft is doing on rearranging components and APIs inside Windows Core. And is there any news if this pattern was like proceeded with the Windows 8 release?
So the rearranging, actually, I talked about it pretty publicly when I was on the Windows team.
Win-win, et cetera.
What's that?
Like Minwin,
yeah, et cetera. I talked about Minwin. That work proceeded. In fact, I talked about the fact that in Windows 7, Minwin was at the bottom of the system, a small, self-contained, basically headless core pieces of the system. But Minwin wasn't very useful by itself. It didn't have the ability to run any software on it to speak of. With Windows 8, the next layers were built on top of Minwin, the same protocol of making it self-contained and separating GUI from the core, and that became Core System, and Core System is at the heart of Windows Phone 8. So that now is becoming the common core for Microsoft's delivery of operating systems in different forms, like phone form, and you'll even see Xbox do the same thing.
Thank you very much. That's very interesting.
Well, my next question is not so technical. It's very interesting how technical decisions are, what is the way of technical decisions in Microsoft, and what is your personal role in these decisions? Well, for example, the idea to change kernel some or that way, and how the decision is made?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to figure that out. So my role is as a senior individual contributor at Microsoft, and this role is challenge. It's both rewarding and challenging. The alternative is to take a management role where you own, you know, basically running a group of people, and you have much more influence when you're, you know, doing the reviews and determining what their bonuses are than somebody like me who is sitting on the side and trying to influence people without any levers like that. So the way that I get aided with my influence is, of course, my reputation. People have, you know, over my history have started trusting what I say and my opinions on things. The other way is the management actually empowers me. And basically, there are certain areas where they view me as the key technical decision maker. One of them was this infrastructure as a service release that we did on Azure, where I was the senior architect for that. So when it came down to technical architecture of that, the management, if I came and I said we should do it this way, then, and nobody said, you know, raised their hand and said that's a stupid idea, and convinced management otherwise, that's the way we did it. The other areas where I have that kind of charter to lead us technically, to lead Azure technically, are in the application model, and as well as data center architecture, and the compute architecture too of Windows Azure. So those are areas where I've been given authority by management to chart things technically. Now, that said, I basically just can't say this is the way we're doing it and, you know, write it down short bullets on a piece of paper and say, here you go. My job is still requires influencing people and getting consensus and making sure that everybody, that all opinions are reflected in the opinions that I render, and making sure that I get everybody bought in on it, because me operating in isolation, if people feel like I'm not taking into account everybody's needs and requirements, they're going to ignore what I say. They're not going to trust that I'm making sound technical, you know, opinions and judgments. So, like I said, it's challenging and it's rewarding. It's rewarding because I don't have to manage people, which I don't want to do. I like to focus on technical learning and investigation and having time to think deeply about problems, which I don't think as a manager I would have time to do. But challenging, on the other hand, because I have to influence still in this role. I don't, does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Why don't we have Hyper-V snapshotting and differencing disks yet in Azure Virtual Machines?
Why don't you have Hyper-V snapshotting and differencing disks? Well, first the snapshotting architecture of Hyper-V is very server focused. It is very local storage focused. The snapshotting that we would have to implement in Azure is consistently snapshotting blobs of the disks of a virtual machine. So that virtual machine that I showed earlier with 16 disks, I showed you how I could copy one of those disks on the fly. And I could make a copy of all of the disks at approximately the same point in time, but they're not going to be consistent with each other, like you are observing. And to get consistency out of it, we need a protocol that has a handshake between the Azure host agent and the storage stack in Hyper-V and the snapshotting components of Hyper-V. So we definitely want to provide that capability, and we've actually sat down with the Hyper-V team to talk about the right way to architect the storage stack to have the hooks in it that we need to be able to do that. So that is something that will come at some point.
And uploading just a differencing disk on top of a previously uploaded VM?
As far as uploading a differencing disk, that's something that we could do. We haven't seen people ask for that. So I don't...
Well, I have seen that.
Okay, that's, I mean, I actually have never, that's not surfaced on any of our lists from customer asks that we've...
In disaster recovery scenarios, this makes sense. Just uploading a differencing disk instead of the full box at a regular interval.
Yeah. I mean, you can do differential backups of the VHDs and then do differential restores of them as well.
True.
But, yeah.
This my question is not technical at all. Do you have a plans to publish your novel Zero Day in Russia?
I have plans to publish it in every language, but the publishers have to decide on that. I can't decide. So Zero Day has been published, I think, in Hungarian, in French, in Korean, in Romanian, and I think maybe another language. I have not been, so I don't get these requests. They go from foreign publishers in whatever country, so some publisher in Russia has to decide they want to publish it in Russian, contacts my publisher and buys the rights to do that. And then the publisher tells me, oh, yay, Russia bought the rights to Zero Day, and then I celebrate, but. Tricky one.
Yeah, sorry. Let me know if you may not speak about that, but I want to ask you for kind of comparison between you and competitors. I'm talking about Azure and the cloud services. I work closely with the mobile developers, and there's a kind of trend. They say that, cloud for Microsoft is something that you want to probably stay out, especially if you do only iOS and Android development. So they mostly prefer AWS as a solution. How do you see Microsoft working on that to change that in the future, let's say in 2-5 years? What would be the picture after that? And we all know why it's like that, but we can assume why people think that. What do you see that Microsoft can do to change that vision and to actually bring people more to Azure and use their services as a basis for their development?
So that's a good question. I think I'm not sure what the developers you're talking to, why they don't like Azure, unless it's just not cool. Microsoft is not cool in certain circles, and so there's certain classes of people that are like, if it's Microsoft, I'm not touching it. There's nothing inherently anti-Android or anti-iOS about the Azure platform. You can write services that integrate, that are backends for those. kinds of mobile clients. In fact, the Azure mobile services, I don't know if you've saw Scott talk about them, but we've got first-class support for iOS, Android's maturing, and basically we're recognized that we can't offer platforms that are targeted only at our clients, because that's not the world that we live in anymore. There's 500,000 Android devices being activated every day. There's 350 million iOS devices out there, and so if we can't just say, if you want to develop a client application for that, we're not going to help you. You're on your own. But if you want one for Windows 8 or Windows Phone 8, you know, then we're here, all 20 of you. So our goal is to support all the clients as first class as we go forward. And of course, we'll introduce support for our platforms first, but it's not to say that we're not going to treat the other ones just as importantly.
But how do you see the possible future, or, you know, how to make a twist?
Yeah, well, the twist is actually the sort of mobile services. You don't have to be a developer to write simple backends. You don't have to be a cloud developer, to a server developer, a backend developer, to write a very simple backends that satisfy many mobile client solutions. And actually, the philosophy of mobile services is just to make it brain dead, to integrate with notification systems of Android and iOS, so you don't have to worry about anything. You just plug in your developer ID and your app ID, and the canned back end of mobile services takes care of all the plumbing for you of scaling out and all of the other things that you don't want to worry about. So I think that's our strategy, is to try to build mobile back end, entry point back end, that addresses large classes of mobile developers, makes it very easy for them, to encourage them to use Windows Azure. And if they want to migrate from that to something more sophisticated, then they can move out into the richer platform as a service.
Well, we see now IT crawling towards clouds, right? Mobile devices, Azure, and is there a vision or at least feeling at Microsoft, what's beyond Azure?
What's beyond Azure? Well, we've got a lot of work to do for Azure, so I don't think we've looked beyond it at this point. I think that this, if you look at these previous phases of computing, they reach about 30 years long. So I think that this cloud era is at least 20 years. I mean, probably the pace of innovation accelerates, so I can't say that this is going to be a 30-year mobile plus cloud. Maybe it's something less than that, but that still we're basically just a few years into that transition right now. And that, like I pointed out in my earlier presentation, the reason I'm in Azure is because there's so many questions, so many unknowns, so many things that we have yet to develop. How do you make an application platform, for example, that makes it easy for you to say, I want this application to be geo-distributed, and to both from an availability perspective, from a disaster recovery perspective, from a locality perspective. I mean, that's the world we're going to move in, where you want the platform to help you create these applications that are running in data centers all over the world, close to the customers, which have become geo customers at this point. And we don't know how to do that yet, to make that easy. It's all rocket science right now still.
Thank you.
Okay, the question is regarding the SQL Azure. Can I ask you?
You can ask.
Okay,
sure.
As far as it's a GA service and we have some kind of SLA on it, I believe it's also quite a common question, but I want to ask it. It's regarding the how fast do we get responses? Because I suppose that we cannot regulate it somehow, and I feel that SQL Azure is shared between some other companies or customers, and it's one issue. So mm-hmm. I cannot have any SLA on the response time. And the second one is sometimes we cannot edit source code, or sometimes we doesn't own a source code, and we have to migrate the application. And okay, some functions are not supported, but we have also an issue with the SQL size. Sometimes we cannot federate databases, and we need a lot bigger size of SQL Azure. Do you plan to make databases for at least 1 terabyte or maybe 10 terabytes in order to be able to migrate existing applications easier?
So let me ask, answer the first question, which is a question that's near and dear to my heart, and I think one of the examples of how far we, anybody working in the cloud space has to go. If you, the question was about performance SLAs. And right now, no cloud vendor offers general performance SLAs. The closest that anybody's come is Amazon with provisioned IOPS. And this is where you're basically buying dedicated resources from a server back to their storage, the EBS storage behind the VMs. But in the general case, nobody's saying, we're giving you an SLA on the number of transactions per second for SQL or the number of queue puts per second on service bus, Windows Azure service bus, or number of writes to AWS S3 storage. And that's because providing SLAs on something like that is extremely difficult in this multi-tenant environment that the cloud is, where you pointed out you feel like you've got a noisy neighbor. That's called noisy neighbor syndrome when you're accessing the service and suddenly your performance drops off. You feel like somebody's just walked in to the apartment next door and turned on the music, and now you can't hear your music because they're playing it so loudly. So this is one of the areas, I think, where the science still needs to mature for how to deal with delivering consistent performance such in a multi-tenant environment such that it's possible to offer SLAs. In fact, I think that one of the direction that we might be heading is for a low-cost offering. There's no SLA, but there's service level objectives, we call them SLOs, where we'll try to deliver a certain quality of service, but no guarantees. And for the most part, we will, you know, if we see hotspots, we'll scale out to relieve the hotspots, but you won't, if the SLO is missed, it's oh well, to more expensive, to basically a premium quality of service that you buy into and say, and this is the model Amazon's basically going down, which is you want guaranteed performance, you want SLAs, and then you basically are paying more to get more dedicated pipe, less over-provisioned pipe in through the system to get that kind of performance. But multi-tenant, delivering quality, consistent performance in a multi-tenant environment, that's an area of rocket science right now.
So am I correct for now you doesn't provide any SLA, but at least we can hope that in future we will have some maybe additional plans when we will be able to place at least some low threshold, but the threshold on which we can hope.
Yes, so it is a committed direction of Windows Azure that all our services will eventually offer SLAs on all important APIs.
Okay.
It's going to take us a while to get to that point, but this is the senior technical leadership of Azure and the business leadership recognizes the need for this to go in this direction. When we go talk to enterprise customers, of course, the first thing they say is, yeah, what kind of performance am I going to get, yeah, from my SQL Server on Azure compared to on-premise? And we today are shooting for service level objectives kind of performance, but we know that if we miss them, that's the same as them not getting the performance that they thought they were going to get, So,
exactly. Yeah.
And also the recognition that even if we don't publish SLAs or SLOs, customers figure it out. You're running your applications, you see what kind of, it's not like we can hide it. Say, oh no, you're going to get awesome performance.
We can always measure. Yeah,
yeah, when you can't, right? So we know that it's better for us to try to get ahead of this and actually tell you what kind of performance you're going to get rather than have you go try to figure it out and then not trust that that's consistent.
Okay, and what about the size of SQL?
SQL, tons of feedback about the size of SQL Azure databases, and there's work both to make it easy to federate databases and to perform operations across them, as well as to increase the size of them. But
unfortunately, it's not always working. Sometimes I just cannot adjust the source code in order to integrate the federation.
Yeah.
Sometimes I have an application which I want to, for example, put into EES and move the SQL to SQL Azure. And sometimes I cannot because the size of SQL Azure is limited.
Yeah, and I think that, this is another interesting phenomenon that you see from box product to cloud software, where box product software is the scale up mentality, right? And the cloud software is scale out. And as Microsoft moves our own software into this new cloud world, a lot of times in the multi-tenant scale-out world, we are unable to deliver all the functionality that you get from your dedicated IaaS scale-up deployment, SQL Server being an example. Now, the goal is that SQL Azure will continue to improve. Okay. The applications that you're worried about will start to age out, and you'll replace them with new applications. And so there'll be a crossover point where it no longer makes sense to worry about the SQL Server type deployments, but we're a ways away from that. It's going to be a while before, you know, all applications, you say it's a no-brainer just to put them on SQL Azure, because there's still requirements that the box product type software has that we won't be able to satisfy for some time.
I see. Thank you.
Good evening. Can you tell me, please, while promoting Windows 7 for the compatibility of previous software products, you have proposed XP mode model, and that there was a certain technology that you have purchased when the application was launched there, and this one, it was shown as a native application. When Windows 8 came to the market, you proposed Hyper Engine, but we don't understand why for devices which can be connected to the USB ports cannot be connected. Applications which are deployed there, they don't work on this technology. So the objective, what is the objective? Which Hyper-V component was included in Windows 8, and what was the reason why you didn't include the component that you had in Windows 7 in Virtual PC?
Because I'm not in a position to answer that question, because I don't know what decision making went into Windows 8, whether it supported XP mode or not. My guess, if I was to guess, and this is completely just a wild guess, is that XP's now, how many years, 11 years old, 12 years old, it's almost at the end of extended life. And so I think that if you look, it's probably Windows 8 was targeted at Vista and Win 7 upgrade, not XP.
Good, but Hyper-V component for the client operational system, the objective of implementation, what is the objective? Why? For the server platform, it's understandable. Hyper-V server platform, it's available. But the client platform, Hyper-V, which is in principle pulls the ports, and you cannot pull the ports because I have devices through the USB ports on the client machine, but I cannot connect them through the Hyper-V. Therefore, what is the objective of implementing it there?
First of all, let me say big or even great thanks for all the tools you developed in SysInternals. We love all of them.
Thanks.
But it's still a question about the Hyper-V in Windows 8. Let me say that, okay, this man...
I apologize.
It's not a question about apologize, it's just a question about the... let's say, architecture inside the system. Well, we can use the Hyper-V in Windows 8 even to realize to, I don't know, to implement the XP mode. It's not a problem. But this summer, we tried to upgrade the pack of our computers. It was, let's say, Dell Optiplex workstations from Windows 7 to Windows 8. And we found, all of a sudden, that Hyper-V, the client Hyper-V, is not working in Windows 8 because it requires some kind of technology called SLAT. I don't know what is this. And after that, we tried to install the Windows 2012 server to the same computer and found that Hyper-V is working. Is there any reason to use this SLAT technology in the client operating system? And the next question, is there any chance that in the future, do you remember, in Windows 7, XP mode was requiring hardware virtualization. Later, in Service Pack 1 or even later, this requirement was canceled, right? So, is there any chance that in Windows 8, you will remove this requirement for SLAT? Because otherwise, we need to...
Yeah, so the SLAT decision, actually, that was made while I was still in Windows, and that was basically by a decision based on... the support required for shadow page tables, which is the software implementation of that same hardware feature, the performance overhead of that, and the fact that when the Windows marketing team went and looked at the deployment of hardware, the PCs that supported second level address translation, the number that were in the market at the time Windows 8 development started and the projections for what would be in the market now, it was overwhelming. You know, all PCs starting 4 years ago had SLAT in them, and so it was deemed not a good use of developer recent test resources to go support shadow page tables in a world where very few customers would actually need it. So I apologize that you're one of the ones that apparently needed it, and as far as the decision being revisited, I don't know. I'm not in Windows, so I don't know.
What do you think about the future of Windows 8? Because history shows that a history of operating system, Windows operating system for desktops shows that successful OS goes after less successful Windows Vista, Windows XP successful, and Windows 8 is next after successful Windows 7.
No comment.
No comment.
Mark, I have a question about security in Azure. How can we assure about the security in the cloud if is that nobody can access our data in data center or in Microsoft or even Big Brother,
yeah.
whatever. And do you plan to develop some kind of encryption for Azure to control the key on our side, on the customer side, so we can ensure that nobody can access our data, our private data, maybe from outside?
Yeah, so the answer to your question is pretty complex. Actually, Slava Kazvin just delivered a session on Windows Azure security this afternoon, I believe. But as far as our measures to protect customer data, especially in two ways, one from us and another from other customers.
Yeah.
The protection from other customers is technology-based, isolation, so that one customer can't interfere with another and penetrate the isolation boundary to get access to your data. From protecting your data from Microsoft, there's very strict guidelines around who can access production systems, and even then, their access is controlled to just what they need for troubleshooting purposes. And this very rarely involves requirement to go and access any data that belongs to a customer. I think I've heard a lot of customers say that they want encryption at rest, and actually I don't think that encryption at rest buys really much in the way of security other than maybe peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you can do encryption at rest today yourself with Windows Azure. You can encrypt the data that goes back to Windows Azure storage blobs yourself if you'd like to.
So it's possible. It's possible for me to encrypt my data.
Yeah, for you. I mean, you're free to write the data in whatever format you want to, so you can put encryption there yourself. For infrastructure as a service VMs, we don't have a BitLocker support at this point. But the risk, you know, what you're defending against with encryption at rest, a couple things potentially is somebody walking into the data center stealing a disk. So our physical security, there's armed guards, there's machines that weigh you on the way in and out, there's cameras everywhere. If anybody's stealing a disk out of a data center, it's like, you know, Ocean's 11 kind of thing would have to happen. So physically, the data it's not really a risk. We never have disks go out of the data center. So once a disk goes in, it's destroyed before it ever leaves the data center. So it's not like your data is going to walk out of our data center either through some other means like that. Even if the server is broken or the disk is broken, it gets destroyed. And when it comes to Microsoft support people or developers accessing the production data, again, there's tight controls over what they have access to while they're in the production system debugging a problem to stop them from going and accessing customer data. So from my perspective, I don't think there's much security benefit to it. Again, you know, part of the cloud is really trust and confidence. And so if we get enough feedback from customers saying they want it, that's likely something we'll implement. But, and that's just a part of building that confidence and trust, is to say, well, if you really feel better and more secure that your data is encrypted at rest, we're going to do that. So we might be doing it at some point if we continue to get this kind of feedback.
Thank you.
Yeah, one.
The final question.
Hey Mark, please tell, is it true that Apple iCloud is hosted in Windows Azure? And if true, what data centers do they use?
I can neither confirm nor deny that.
We have a fifth edition of Windows internals,
yeah,
covering Windows Vista, when we have Windows 7 on shelf.
Yeah.
This year we have, at the same time, Windows 8 and the sixth edition.
Uh-huh.
Can we hope we have put in hand the seventh edition before the Windows 9?
You can hope.
Well, actually, the
kind of sad fact of the matter is that I will not be working on the books anymore. In fact, Alex Ionescu, my other two co-authors, David Solomon, David's mostly retired, and Alex Ionescu is working now a full-time job at a security company. I'm focusing on Azure full-time. So we were lucky to even have the momentum to get the sixth edition out. I don't think there will be a seventh edition from us, and actually, from what I've seen, probably nobody else, because it's a tremendous, just incredible amount of work to produce the updates to the books. And if you look at the publishing business, you can chart the sales of the Windows Internals book series, starting from Inside Windows NT, the first edition, and it's basically a straight line down in terms of each edition selling fewer and fewer copies. So it's just not that many people interested in it anymore. So unfortunately, it looks like sixth edition might be the last one.
Mark, what do you think about consumerization of IT and Microsoft, and especially Windows?
Well, consumerization of IT, what I think of it is that it's absolutely a fact of life. I mean, we've seen, especially driven by Apple devices, iPhones and iPads walking into, you know, the companies, and especially the C-level people, the directors walking in and saying to the IT staff, I'm using this, I don't care what you say, and you know, it's your job to support me doing that. So from Microsoft's perspective, we recognize that it's something that IT has to deal with, and the IT policies and mechanisms and tools have to accommodate. I think that what Microsoft's focus is at this point is supporting all devices, so not just for mobile development, but also for mobile device management. Microsoft will provide solutions that allow you to manage client devices from other vendors, but also focusing on data management, which I think is fundamentally what enterprises are concerned about, is the data that's on those devices and making sure that that's protected. And you're going to see Office playing a role in that as well, and making sure that if you want to, documents that are encrypted and documents that are released only if you're logging into the device from a certain place with certain kinds of health policy in place, remote attestation on the device saying that it's not running out of policy in terms of, and this is not so strict as what you've seen in the PC area, but But in terms of do you have a password of the right policy? I mean, you see this with Exchange Server, EAS, and the fact that it won't let you, the IT can configure it so that you need a PIN on the device to be able to access the email. I think you just see that those kinds of measures extended, the management for them, as well as the implementation and different applications for them, and integration and data management and applications as a kind of data protection platform services for mobile devices.
Do you see the possible
trend in developers? Do I see what?
The possible
trend in the developers area and consumerization of development. What do you mean by that? Yeah. Actually, that's a really funny question because I had dinner with Jeffrey Snover last night and we were laughing at Microsoft's several attempts to democratize programming. I can't remember, there was a Popfly, was a project, software product that was developed on the web. When I joined Microsoft, this was like in 2006, 2007, all you could hear about at Microsoft was democratizing programming, make it easy for the non-programmer to program. And I would just scratch my head at this, and there was another project called Oslo, which was domain-specific language support and visual programming for these domains. And again, even that, which is aimed at a more technical audience, I didn't get it. I mean, the thing is, to program, you have to have logical thought. You have to say if A happens, B and C can happen, you know. You have to have structures that you keep track of in your head for control flows, and that's just at a very simple level. Ignore asynchrony and failure handling and all the other things that you really require to write a robust program. And I just don't see that most non-developers are going to want to exert the brain power to go and figure out how to do that kind of stuff. So, other than, I don't know, shopping lists and things like that. So, I personally don't think that this everybody being a programmer is really something real.
You're safe.
What's that? I think you're safe. Yeah, job security.
The final question.
Hi, Mark. What do you think of, or how often the customers ask you to implement something like dynamic scalability for Azure? From the other hand, they will pay less, but it's a cool feature, I guess.
So the autoscale feature, this is kind of a funny one too, because ever since I joined the Azure group, we frequently go through prioritization exercises. We say, here, what are the things that we need to develop that customers are asking for, that we feel like there's gaps in the platform? Every time we start out with that list, it's like everything we can think of, and autoscale is on that list every single time. And every single time, autoscale falls off the bottom. In fact, it's falling off the bottom again right now. So it's a great opportunity for third parties, is the way that I view that. We will eventually, it'll eventually, it's just got to bubble up into the list and actually make the cut at some point. But right now, we've got so many more fundamental features and functionality that we want to implement that it's just still not making the cut. And it's not because we want to, say, ooh, yeah, look, if they can't control scale, look, they're going to run their VMs longer and we can get more money. But
thank you.
Thank you for
okay. Thanks, everybody.
All the questions and answers.
Samsung серии 9 – невероятно тонкий 15-дюймовый ноутбук. Потрясающий дизайн. 10-часовой заряд батареи. Еще остались сомнения? Молниеносная загрузка решает все вопросы. Мгновенно. Пришло время побеждать.
Привет, меня зовут Павел Голуб, я продакт-маркетинг-менеджер в компании Abbi. Abbi – это международная компания разработчик программного обеспечения со штаб-квартирой в России. Abbi специализируется на распознавании текста, документов, а также лингвистических продуктах и сервисах. Широко известный словарь Abbi Lingua – это продукт с 20-летней историей и более чем 10 миллионами пользователей на разных платформах и устройствах. И вот теперь мы рады представить вам Abbi Lingua для Windows Phone. Приложение специально разрабатывалось с учетом особенностей и специфики среды Windows Phone, которые идеально подходят для создания облачных интернет-решений. Abbi Lingua полностью соответствует этой парадигме. Например, приложение предоставляет онлайн-доступ сразу к большому количеству словарей, при этом занимая менее 1 мегабайта памяти на мобильном устройстве. В процессе разработки мы использовали Microsoft Visual Studio – стабильную высокопроизводительную среду разработки приложений. Начните использовать Lingua. Уверен, что вам пригодится надежный словарный помощник.